take a few minutes, first of all, just to have everyone introduce themselves in case we don't all know each other. And if it might be helpful for everyone to also just mention how many years you've been in the legislature and how many years, if you have prior service on the tax committee. And Representative Phil Krinke, I represent District 53A, Northern Ramsey County and part of Southern Anoka County. This is my eighth term, and I believe this is starting my my fourth term of interrupted service on the tax committee. And Dean, why don't you...
Representing Dean Simpson, I represent Otter Tail County, half Otter Tail County, Washington County, two townships, up in Becker County. This is my second term, and this will be my second term on the tax committee.
I'm Representative Brian Abrams from Minnetonka. This is my ninth term and my eighth term on the tax committee.
Representative Greg Davis, District 31B. It's Fillmore, Houston Counties. I border Wisconsin and Iowa. This is my 15th year in the House, but I'm a freshman on the tax committee.
Welcome.
Laura Broad, I represent 25A, and I'm in my second term, and I'll be starting my second term here on the tax committee.
Maury Lanning, District 9A, Moorhead and Northern Clay County, and this is my second term in the House, second term on the tax committee.
Larry Howes, Walker, Minnesota, home of the U-Pout Festival and Moondance Jam. My fourth term and first time on this committee.
Chris DeLaForest, I represent District 49A, Central Anoka County. This is my second term in the House, and I'm newly drafted to the Tax Committee.
My name is Andy Westerberg. I'm in my fourth term here at the House, and I'm new to the Tax Committee, but I represent the cities of Blaine, the home of the largest amateur sports complex in the entire country.
I'm Pete Nelson, representing District 17B, which is most of Chicago County, also known as the Swedish Riviera. My second term here and my second stint on the Tax Committee. And Mr. Chairman, I have a guest as long as I've got the floor. Mika, you want to stand up? Mika is visiting us today, and she comes from Ukraine. So.
Dobrodošli.
Kurt Zeller, represent District 32B, which is the eastern side of Maple Grove and the entire city of Osseo. It's my second term on tax committee, so according to Bill Queasley, I'm now allowed to talk.
That was according to Queasley.
Paul Coles, I represent District 34A, which is central, central and western Carver County and a small piece of Scott County, in my second term and my second term on the tax committee.
Ann?
I'm Ann Lanchesky. I represent Bloomington. I've been in the legislature 6 years, and I've been on the tax committee since I started in the legislature.
I'm Irv Anderson. I represent 3A. International Falls, and I'm serving my 17th term, and I've been on tax committee every year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
from Duluth, District 7B, and I think I'm in my 15th term, and I've been on tax committee most of the time that I've been here. I don't know how many years.
Tom Rukabina, District 5A. I represent. I'm the only Iron Ranger with an entirely Iron Range district. So, and I'm in my 10th term, and I served 6 years under Chair Abrams, and I think 6 years under Chair Rett. And they wouldn't let me on the tax committee before that.
I'm going to let that pass. Jim Dabney, starting my third term here in the House, first day on the tax committee.
Joe Mullery, Minneapolis, starting my year and fifth year on the House.
Connie Bernardi, represent the communities of Blaine, Spring Lake Park, Moundsview, and Fridley. And this is my second non-consecutive year on the tax committee.
I'm Paul Marquardt, represent District 9B, which includes parts of Clay and Becker County, all of Wilkin and Traverse County. This is my third term in legislature and second term on the tax committee.
Joe Atkins, happy to be back on tax committee again. Spent my whole legislative career here. now in my second term, Mr. Chair, welcome. Welcome aboard. I represent Inver Grove Heights, South St. Paul, and Sunfish Lake.
David Dill, first term on the tax committee, second term legislature, represent what's known as the Minnesota Arrowhead.
I'm Lyle Coonan. I represent District 20B, which is Renville County, Chippewa County, and the east half of Yellow Medicine County. This is my second term in the House and first term on tax committee.
I'm John Lesh. I represent the north end and the east side of St. Paul, home of actually Larry and Andy, the world's largest stick shift knob. So I know that's not me. This is my second term, my first term on the tax committee.
Welcome, everyone. And then I'd like to have Representative Knobloch. I guess you didn't get to introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Representative Jim Knobloch, District 15A, St. Cloud and the surrounding area. I was listening to Representative Zeller's talk about how he was here last time and he could vote but not talk. I was an ex officio member of this committee last term, and I could talk but not vote. So I'm glad to be here as a full member, second term as a full member.
Then obviously all the members get the vote, but all the staff that makes this committee run and gives us overwhelming amounts of information. Committee Administrator, you want to start?
I'm Craig Stone, Committee Administrator. Been with the chair for the last 6 years. New to the Tax Committee, new to House TV, so I'll have to remember to keep my hair combed.
Jeremy Espenson, new to the committee and new to the chair, formerly with Representative Lanning and Representative Olson. Second year here. Looking forward to working with you.
We have other research staff and caucus staff.
yeah, my name is Chris Martin. I'm a GOP researcher.
And we have our DFL research.
Brian Dower, House DFL research. I'll be starting my next session.
And then before we start the program for today, maybe we could have our most capable and competent House research staff and fiscal staff go through your introduction as well.
I'm Joel Michael. I'm with House Research, and I guess I'll let everybody else. What? And I've let's see, this will be my
tell the truth now.
I think this is my 29th session, so I've been around a while. Almost all of it on tax.
Paul Wilson, I'm with the House Fiscal Staff. This is my 7th year.
Nina Manning with House Research. I work mostly in income tax, and this is my 15th year.
Pat Dalton with House Research. I do sales taxes and I do local government aid, and I've been here. This is my 18th session.
Karen Baker, House Research, I think she's permanent where it's all on taxes, and from the property tax and law.
Steve Hines, House Research, also on property taxes, also starting my 29th session.
29th year, 29th session.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rupavina.
Chair, could we have the most important thing, the pages?
Yes, we have a page.
I'm Ian Marsh. I'll be your page for the text.
That's all we have? Is one? Sure. I thought you had four with the speaker.
You know better than that, Representative Rupavina. So, today what we're going to do, members, is just have our staff go through an overview of taxes just to acquaint us with all those things that we may have forgotten over the interim. And so we'll turn it over to them. One thing, members, I would just like to ask as we embark on this session, you know, we have a fairly large committee, and so as we go through these presentations and we have other people come to testify before the committee, just to be respectful of other committee members' time, and we obviously will have a lot of information and a lot of discussion, but as we go through this, again, just be respectful of other members' time and allow us to move through the agenda as quickly as possible. If there's time, obviously, at the end of the meeting, we can embark. And probably the only other thing we want to do is today is we wanted to vote on whether we should have a gag order on Representative Rukavina.
So,
motion passed unanimously. Thank you very much.
Okay. I want to know who's going to implement it.
Kyle.
You've been gagged.
I'll pick Representative Brad.
Okay. Now that we've got that small formality taken care of, please, to the overview, which one do you want to... We're going to start with...
Mr. Chairman, I'll start with just a few preliminary remarks. And I think in terms of the staffing, in your packets you have a list, which on one side has our names on it and underneath the taxes that we do. And on the reverse side, there's a list that's alphabetized by subject matter. So you can... One of the confusing things with a fairly large staff like this is who do you call to get an answer about a specific task. And this list is designed to help with that. The fiscal analysts are on the top and the House research on the bottom, and of course we overlap in subject areas. We work very closely together. You can call either one of us, and often we'll consult with each other. If you don't want us to do that, please tell us. But anyway, so that, just to get that out of the way. Basically, what we're going to do is do a really two-part overview. First, we're going to start and try to go through the tax system and talk about sort of the substantive issues with taxes. After we finish with that, which will probably be on definitely on Thursday, we'll talk about some process issues, things like revenue estimates, fiscal notes, spreadsheets for the committee, House Research's modeling of income property tax, state aids, and how to reuse that, those kinds of things, our confidentiality policies and so forth. But first we're going to go over the sort of the basics of the tax system. And the point I would like to make is that what we're going to do is going to be very cursory. I mean, it's just by the nature of it, and trying to go through all of the tax system in an hour and a half or 2 hours. There's not time. What we'd like to do is to offer, if there are any members who would like in a smaller setting to sit down with one or two or all of us to talk about specific issues or specific tax, if you want to talk about state aids to local governments, or if you want to talk about property taxes or tax increment financing, whatever, we're happy to do that. And just, you know, let me know or let any one of us know, and we can set up something like that where we can get into more detail and have a sort of informal give and take discussion. Next point I'd like to make is in your packets you have two handouts. One of them is called the overview of this, basically the state taxes, income, corporate franchise sales, and so forth. And the other one is property taxes. These have a lot more detail than what we can cover. You can use them like a reference guide just refer to them. Sometimes we'll refer to them. All of the information is not in the PowerPoint that we're going to go through. We did not print copies of the PowerPoint. If you want that, we can certainly do that, or we can email it to you, too, for that matter. I guess one last preliminary remark. Other background information on taxes you can get on the House Research website or on the Fiscal Analysis website. There's a bunch of stuff that's available there. There are also paper publications from both offices that are useful. The other thing is there are three Department of Revenue background publications that I would like to bring to everybody's attention. The people who've been on the committee before are very familiar with these things, but for new folks it's useful to keep that in mind. First one, and there should be a new version of this coming out, is the Minnesota Tax Handbook. All of these are Department of Revenue publications. They're also available on their website. And this has sort of thumbnail explanations of each of the taxes, major changes that have been made in revenues. Second thing is the tax incidence study, which Revenue puts out. There will be a new one coming out in February. This study analyzes who really pays the taxes, because we all know that individuals really pay taxes, even if, you know, businesses remit them, and this makes an effort to estimate by income distribution who pays the tax, and it's a very useful document. You'll find, I think, a lot of, you know, references and talking about it during the committee discussions over the session. The final document is the tax expenditure budget, which the new one will come out next year, and it catalogs sort of the cost of all of the exemptions and credits and so forth in all of the state tax systems. So those are all documents that are useful to have as references to help answer questions and get information. With that, I'll turn it over to Paul, who's going to start the presentation.
Okay, on the slide you'll see a summary of total state tax revenues. Total state tax collections projected for fiscal year 2005 totaled $14.9 billion. That includes, and what's shown here includes all funds, not just the general fund. So funds, taxes that are dedicated to transit or highways or Minnesota Care are included in the total for state tax revenues. We'll start by looking at only state taxes. The second handout deals with property taxes and other local taxes, or the property tax at least, which is a major local tax. So this is only state taxes. And remember that taxes are only one source of state revenue. About 61% of state revenue comes from taxes. Another 13% comes from non-taxes, fees, investment income, tobacco payments, etc. And 26% of state funds come from our federal funds, basically. So we're only looking at the state tax revenue in this case. The slide shows the relative importance of different taxes. The income tax, individual income tax, is by far the most important or the largest tax in revenue, accounting for 41.4% of total revenue, total state tax revenue. The state sales tax, if we include the motor vehicle sales tax in the total, accounts for about a third of state tax revenue. The corporate tax is a very distant third in revenue in the projections for 2005. And you can see the other taxes listed. We're going to go through each of these taxes in turn, starting from the largest and proceeding to toward the smallest. Income tax collections are forecast for fiscal year 2005 are forecast for a little over $6 billion. All of that goes to the general fund. Again, it represents roughly 40%. Roughly 40% of total state tax revenue. The next slide shows the distribution of, the history of individual income tax collections since 1995. Both in actual dollars and in constant 2005 dollars adjusted for inflation. If you look at the slide, you'll notice that revenues rose fairly rapidly between 1995 and 2001. In actual dollars, they rose at a rate of about 7.5% per year on average, which is faster than personal income went up. And that's despite the tax cuts that were enacted that took effect for fiscal year 2000 and 2001. If you look at that, the lack of any tax increase in collections in fiscal year 1998 is simply due to the fact that there was a property tax rebate that year, which was reported or taken as a tax reduction on the income tax form. Otherwise, and that's the only reason for the flat collections in that year. Starting in 2001, of course, with the recession, revenues fell. In 2002 and 2003, in nominal dollars, in actual dollars, 2005 will surpass the prior peak of fiscal year 2001. But if we adjust for inflation, we're still going to be below fiscal year 2001 collections in 2005. The next two slides will show how income tax liability is distributed across the population using data from the latest Department of Revenue Tax Incident Study, which Joel mentioned earlier. This data is actually from tax year 2000. The new study released in February will use 2002 data. Total income tax liability for the state as a whole, if total
income tax payments and divide by total household income, we get an average of about 4.2% effective tax rate. But the effective tax rate, the burden as a percent of income, rises steadily from a negative 0.7% of income to the poorest fifth of the population of Minnesota households, rather. And the poorest fifth of those with incomes less than about $14,700. It rises from that steadily up to 5.2% of income for the richest fifth of households in Minnesota, those with income over about $72,600. And then up to 6.1% effective tax rate for the richest 1%, those with incomes over about $365,000. Because the effective tax rate rises with income in this way, economists describe the income tax as a progressive tax. The next slide shows the proportion of the total tax paid by each of these quintiles or fifths of the population of households. The richest fifth of Minnesota households, again, that's those with incomes over about $72,000, had 57% of total state income, but paid over 70% of the total income tax. So for the fifth quintile on the PowerPoint, fifth quintile, 70.6%. Again, they had 57% of the income, but paid 70% of the tax. The richest 1% of Minnesota households with incomes over $365,000 had about 17% of total income, but as shown on the overhead, paid about 25% of the tax. Again, showing the progressive nature of the income tax. At this point, I'll hand off to Nina Manzi.
Minnesota's individual income tax relies on the federal income tax for its calculation. We use federal taxable income as our starting point for the income tax. So a taxpayer will fill out their federal return and they get to the federal taxable income line and simply transfer that over to their Minnesota form. So we really follow along on a lot of the federal law for deductions and exemptions. This makes the tax relatively easy for taxpayers to comply with and relatively simple for the state to administer because the state can rely on the Internal Revenue Service to verify that federal taxable income number for us. When they find people where they think there's a mistake in their FBI, they pass that information along to our state department for enforcement purposes. We do this by updating on a regular basis to federal tax law changes. We've gotten a little bit behind on that because there were two federal tax bills passed prior to the 2004 session. Since there was no tax bill enacted last year, we haven't updated to those two bills. So this year, Minnesota's tax form has a separate schedule that's called the M1MC, which we all think stands for M1 Nonconformity, and it requires us to add back a number of things that the federal government is now allowing as deductions, but which we haven't yet conformed to. Meanwhile, since the end of last session, the federal government has enacted at least three more tax bills that have an effect on federal taxable income. So I expect those will probably be getting some discussion in committee here in the coming weeks. Minnesota's income tax is progressive, as Paul noted. It has three rates. The low rate is 5.35%. The top rate is 7.85%. The slide shows you the brackets that apply for married joint couples filing returns. The top rate applies at over about $115,000. Those brackets are indexed each year for inflation. The brackets for single filers and for head of household filers, and the head of household is a single filer with a dependent, are lower than the bracket levels for the married joint filers. Minnesota allows both deductions and credits. So we start with federal taxable income, and then we allow some of our own deductions, which serve to reduce Minnesota taxable income. After we've arrived at Minnesota taxable income, people calculate what their tax liability is, and then Minnesota allows several credits, and credits directly offset tax. So the difference between the two is that a deduction reduces taxable income, and a credit directly reduces tax. Several of Minnesota's deductions are required by federal law. These are things that the federal government says to the states that you can't tax these. We're not allowed to tax U.S. savings bond interest. We're not allowed to tax railroad retirement benefits or on-reservation earnings by Indian tribes. Minnesota also has several deductions which we have chosen to allow. The first one, probably the oldest one, is for K-12 education expenses. This includes tuition. It's up to $2,500 a year for students in grades 7 through 12 and $1,625 for students in grades K through 6. We also allow a charitable contribution deduction for people who don't itemize at the federal level. You all may be familiar that if you itemize deductions at the federal level, you can deduct your charitable contributions. People who don't itemize at the state level can deduct 50% of their contributions to the extent those contributions in the year exceed $500. There's a elderly subtraction that primarily applies to low-income elderly filers who, for one reason or another, do not have Social Security income, and those are our major deductions. Returning to the credits, which serve to directly offset tax, there are two kinds of these. A non-refundable credit only offsets the taxpayer's liability. So if the taxpayer has no tax, a non-refundable credit is not going to do them any good. A refundable credit is a mechanism through which the tax code is used to really make transfer payments to individuals. If an individual is eligible for a refundable credit, and their refundable credit is greater than the tax they owe, they get the excess sent to them as a check. So a person may have no tax liability at all and qualify for a refundable credit, and they will get a refund check from the state. And I'll talk about those refundable credits in a little more detail in just a minute or two. The non-refundable credits, there are four of them. The marriage penalty credit serves to offset the marriage penalty that is implicit in Minnesota's rate and bracket system. I mentioned a little bit that the brackets are different for different kinds of filers, and those serve to impose a penalty on filers, on couples in which both spouses have income. When they get married, they have less tax at the lowest rate, so they end up paying more tax. And Minnesota's marriage penalty credit is intended to offset that additional state tax that they pay as a result of getting married. There's a credit for taxes paid to other states so that there isn't double taxation of the same income. There's a credit for long-term care insurance premiums and a credit for transit passes. The marriage credit, as I mentioned a bit, is based on the earnings of each spouse, and earnings being wages, and then it's also the taxable pension income of each spouse. The maximum credit in 2005 will be about $300, and the cost of this credit is estimated at just under $60 million in fiscal 2005. The long-term care credit equals 25% of the premiums that aren't claimed as a federal deduction. The maximum credit is $100 per person and $200 for married couples. The cost of this credit has been going up slowly over the years since it was enacted, and it's projected to be about $6.5 million in 2005. And these are the refundable credits. So these are the ones for which if you get one of these credits, you'll get a check even if you don't have tax liability. They're the working family credit, the K-12 education credit, and the dependent care credit. The working family credit sort of follows along with the federal earned income credit. And this credit is like a wage subsidy. It equals a percentage of earnings. So if you don't have a job and you don't have earnings, you're not going to qualify for this credit. The amount of the credit you get increases if you have children. The maximum credit if you have two or more children is just over $1,500. It's about $800 if you have one child, and it's only $100 for filers without children. The maximum credit is adjusted annually for inflation. This credit is subject to an income-based phase-out, so it's like a targeted wage subsidy to low-income filers. and it's intended to help the most people who have children. The maximum income eligible in 2005 is about $35,000 for families with two or more children, and it's less than that for families with one child, and it's really a very low level for families without children. This phase-out also goes up a little bit annually for inflation. The total cost of the working family credit is estimated at about $134 million in fiscal year 2005. So you see, it's quite a large program. It's a lot of money that goes out in the working family credit. The average credit in 2002 was just over $500, and there were about 250,000 people who claimed the credit in 2002.
Excuse me one moment, Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the $134 million cost, do we know the portion of that that is provided to filers who have no tax liability? Is that broken out?
We do know that. I don't think I have that information with me today. My recollection is that it's a large percentage of it does not go to refund, to offset liability. There's probably around 25% of it that offsets liability, and then the rest of it is issued as a refund. And I can find that out and send it to you and the committee for the next meeting.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next refundable credit is the K-12 education credit. This one, some of you probably here when it was enacted in 1998. It's the newest of the refundable credits. It offsets 75% of K-12 education expenses up to $1,000 per child and $2,000 per family. Like the working family credit, it's also subject to an income-based phase-out. The difference with this one is that the phase-out is not adjusted annually for inflation. It started out in 1998 at a maximum income of $37,500, and that's where it still is. Eligible expenses for this credit are a whole lot of things except tuition, and that's sort of the key point, is that tuition does not qualify for the K-12 education credit. It does qualify for the deduction, but it doesn't qualify for the credit. Other than that, the expenses that qualify for these two programs are the same. There's a list of them up on the slide: tutoring, books, fees for transportation, music lessons and instruments, after-school programs and academic summer camps, and then up to $200 per year in educational computer hardware and software. The total cost of the credit is estimated at $13.8 million in fiscal year 2005. The average in 2002 was $262 per claimant and just under 60,000 claimants. The average we expect will go down somewhat in 2005. In 2002, where that average is calculated from, the credit was equal to 100% of qualifying expenses. It since has been reduced to equal 75% of qualifying expenses. The deduction, which I mentioned just a minute ago, there's no income limit for the deduction. The difference between the eligible expenses is that tuition is allowed for the deduction, and the maximum is the $2,500 and the $1,625 for the younger kids. The final refundable credit is the dependent care credit, and this is tied to the federal dependent care credit and based on child care expenses. These are expenses that you pay for child care while you are either working or seeking work. The maximum credit at the state level is $720 if you have one child receiving care, and then $1,440 for two or more children. This credit is refundable, and it is, like the other refundable credits, subject to an income-based phase-out. The maximum income here is about $34,000 in 2005. So you see that for all three of the refundable credits, eligibility for them ends when your income gets into the $30,000 range. This one is also adjusted annually for inflation. The credit's estimated to cost $15.4 million in 2005. The average in 2002 was about $321. This credit has been very stable over time. The average has stayed about the same, and the cost has stayed relatively flat. We're seeing a little increase projected in the cost going forward, which could be due to reductions in other sources of child care funding. There have historically always been about 30,000 people claiming this credit. And with that, we've reached the end of the income tax portion, so I'll turn it over to Paul Wilson to start off sales tax, and then he'll send it to Pat. Thank you.
Minnesota is one of 46 states and the District of Columbia that levy a sales and use tax. And revenue is projected for 2005, revenue of $4.8 billion, or about a third of state tax revenues is projected. This again includes about $523 million in motor vehicle sales tax. Motor vehicle sales tax is administered as a separate tax, but at the same rate. And so in the handout, at least the totals are lumped together. All of the sales tax goes to the general fund, except about half of the motor vehicle sales tax, which goes to highways and transit. And part of the tax, or most of the tax on lottery tickets, the sales tax on lottery tickets is an in-lieu tax, in-lieu of sales tax, but that money goes to natural resource funds, most of it. Department of Revenue also estimates that about 44% of sales tax is actually paid on purchases by business rather than by consumers. So 56% on consumer purchases, about 44% on business purchases. The next slide, again, as we did for the income tax, just shows the history of tax collections between 1995 and projected for 2005. What you can see, if you ignore the sales tax rebates, and be careful with sales tax revenue numbers if you see them, in the years of the rebates, sometimes sales tax revenue is reported after the rebate is subtracted and sometimes before it's subtracted. But you see the rebates those 3 years obviously reduced revenue. But if we ignore that, revenue grew in actual dollars at a rate of about 6% per year between 1995 and 2001. That's slightly slower than the increase in personal income. If you contrast that to what we saw with the income tax, which grew faster than the growth in personal income, even though there were substantial income tax cuts over those same years. Again, after 2001, you see a slowdown in the growth. Sales tax revenues never went down, if you include motor vehicle sales tax in the total, but they grew much more slowly, and it continued to grow much more slowly since that time. The next slide shows, as we did with income tax, the effective sales tax rates as a percent of income. The Department of Revenue assumes that much of the burden of the sales tax on business purchases, and this is in the incident study, much of that is shifted to Minnesota consumers and higher prices. And the results you show here include the business part as it's assumed to be shifted to households in higher prices and other forms. The total burden of the sales tax falls from 5.6% of income for the poorest fifth of Minnesotans, those earning less than $14,700, to 2.1% for the richest fifth with incomes over $72,000. And all the way down to 0.8% for the richest 1% with incomes over $364,000. Because the effective tax rate falls with income, the economists describe the sales tax as a regressive tax. In a similar form to what we do with income tax, the next slide shows that despite lower effective tax rates at the higher income levels, the richest fifth of Minnesota households, the fifth quintile, pays 43% of all sales taxes. Again, that 43% that they pay of sales taxes is significantly less than their share of total income at 57%. The poorest fifth of Minnesota households, the first quintile, has only about 3% of total income but pays about 6% of the total tax.
As you know, the general sales tax rate in this state is 6.5%, and it's been there since they enacted a optional local sales tax back in the early 1990s. There are two items that we have a special sales tax rate on. One is alcoholic beverages, and the other is rental motor vehicles. They're taxed at 9% and 12.7%. But as many of you may have heard, those two incrementally larger taxes are set to expire on the end of this year, 12/31/05. That's because at one time the streamlined sales tax project, which the state was trying to conform with, required that states go to one rate for everything that was in their sales tax base. Since we've complied with that, the streamlined sales tax agreement, which we will talk about a little bit later, has been modified somewhat, and motor vehicles are no longer subject to that one rate requirement. So the rental motor vehicle sales tax could continue at the 12.7% rate without bringing us further out of compliance with streamlined sales tax. However, there is not that same ability to deal with the alcoholic beverage tax. If that continued at 9.0%, the state would be further from compliance with streamlined sales tax agreement than it currently is. So that's
Ms. Dalton, excuse me one moment. We have a couple of questions. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, could you inform the members of the committee about the session law language included in the 2001 tax bill dealing with this, about alternative revenue sources, so that it wasn't supposed to be a tax cut, but that the department was supposed to come back with alternative ways in which to raise the money that was going to be the difference between the current rate and whatever. Could you refresh people's memories regarding that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, that is correct. When these sunsets were put in place, the law also required the department to do studies, and they did do the alcoholic beverage study that said find another way of imposing these taxes that would be revenue neutral and would minimize the impact on individual sectors within those economies, within those sectors. So particularly the alcoholic beverage tax. You know, if you imposed it on the wholesalers, how could you do it in a way that would kind of keep the tax the same between on sale and off sale? And there is a study that was done, if we could talk about, or if somebody would like to see it, I can get you a copy of it.
Representative Mueller, do you have a question or comment?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, you answered part of my question, was that can't we avoid it or get around it by the wholesale, but does that then have to be, you raised an issue, does it have to be the same rate from the wholesaler to a non-sale as an off-sale?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller raised, the study actually looked at several different alternatives, from a gross receipt to differential wholesale rates to a wholesale tax that's based on value as opposed to volume, which our current liquor tax is based, wholesale liquor tax is based on volume as opposed to value. So there are several alternatives that were outlined in the study.
I'm sorry, Representative Rupalina.
Ms. Dalton, could you tell the committee that, you know, what happens if we don't conform? Do we have to join Canada? Which is good for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rupalina, right now there's no immediate impact of not conforming. If you're okay, I'd like to defer that discussion until I just get to the streamlined sales tax, which I'll get to in a few minutes.
Okay. But one other question on the alcoholic beverage.
Representative Wrigley.
Mr. Chair, is the 9% apply to on and off sale or just on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rubina, it applies to both on and off sale.
Well, I always thought I got a discount at the liquor store. But I might be thinking.
So let's continue then, Ms. Dolan. Thank you.
The sales tax base is fairly easy to describe. Generally, tangible goods, personal property, are taxable unless specifically exempted under our law. and services usually are not taxable unless specifically included. Minnesota does tax a number of services, such as car washing, towing, dry cleaning, building cleaning and maintenance, detective and security services, lawn care, things like that. But those have all been explicitly included into our sales tax. Minnesota has a number of exemptions in the sales tax law. The law divides the exemptions into a couple of different groupings. One is exemptions that generally apply to individuals. The major exemptions for individuals, as most of you know, are food for home consumption and clothing. We also exempt home heating fuels, motor vehicles, which are subject to the gas tax instead. Prescription drugs, pain relievers such as aspirin, and newspapers and subscription magazines. We've been moving towards exempting many major business and farm purchases from the sales tax. There was a study several years ago back in the middle 1990s that looked at capital equipment and the pyramiding that happens if you impose sales tax on business inputs as well as taxing business outputs. The major exemptions for businesses include capital equipment, farm machinery, certain direct inputs to production, and certain direct inputs to taxable services. Finally, the other major group of sales tax exemptions are exemptions that are entity-based. They're exemptions on sales to schools, the federal government, public libraries and hospitals. We exempt some selected sales to other local governments, particularly as it relates to public safety equipment. We exempt sales to nonprofit charitable organizations if the sales are going to be used directly for the purpose for which they're a nonprofit. And then we also exempt certain sales by nonprofit charitable organizations like the Boy Scouts and school groups and some senior citizens groups. As Paul mentioned earlier, the sales tax collections in this state are not growing aren't growing as quickly as personal income is increasing. And one of the reasons is because of the growth in remote sales. The state is constitutionally prohibited from imposing a duty to collect sales tax on remote sellers. We can't make remote sellers collect their tax unless they have a physical presence in the state. Congress has been told that they have the ability to impose this duty to collect on remote sellers, but they haven't done so at this point. State revenue losses from remote sales, which is both internet and catalog sales, is about $250 million for 2005. Most of that money is internet sales. It's about $190 million is internet sales in 2005. That's expected to increase to $270 million a year by 2007. So the growth in these remote sales and our loss of revenue from remote sales is in internet taxation.
Mr. Stolten, just a technicality here, but how can you lose something you never had?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sales tax is actually a tax that is owed on all items purchased for use in this state. And we do have a complementary use tax as well as a sales tax. We can make businesses pay that use tax because we essentially audit businesses. So we can go in and say, if you bought something remotely from a business and you haven't paid sales tax, we may catch you an audit and then you're going to have to pay. So businesses tend to pay use tax. It's very hard to get individuals to pay use tax because they don't know that they owe it oftentimes. And it's very hard for us to measure what they owe and, audit them, figure out how to make them pay.
Okay, Mr. Stolten, Representative Rucavina, question?
So, Mr. Chair and Pat, when I'm looking in that tall man's catalog that I get, it says, Connecticut residents and that pay this. Is it because, there are certain catalogs where you'll see that? How does that state impose a sales tax on a catalog? So? Illegally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina, My guess is that that business has some physical presence in that state. If they have a warehouse, if they have a call center, if they have something. Land's End with, you know, has a lot of facilities in Wisconsin. Wisconsin clearly has the ability to collect sales tax on all of their catalog sales to Wisconsin residents.
Representative Mullery, question. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton. Two questions. One would be, so if we got HP and Dell to, if we gave them some incentive to set up some little shop here, we'd probably make the tax incentive to them pay off real quickly. Second, that's just an aside, but could we legally, while we can't make them collect it, could we make them, whoever, notify us of the purchase by somebody? That would not, it seems like the reason that we can't do the taxing them is the difficulty. If we can ever get into a streamlined sales tax, then obviously the reason that we can't do it now is because of the difficulty for the under, I can't remember the U.S. Supreme Court decision name, but starts with a Q, I think. That wouldn't be, it would be very, you wouldn't run into that issue if you required them to notify you of purchases. So why couldn't we do that legally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery. The case you're referring to is Quill. And they essentially said it's an undue burden on interstate commerce to require sellers without a physical presence in your state to collect your sales tax. And whether we should make them reveal their customer information, I would defer that question to our lawyer, to Joel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I can't give you a good answer to that. The Quill case essentially divided nexus, which that's the legal term for whether or not there's enough contact with the state, those nexus rules into two sets, and that was sort of one of the unique things of that case. The due process elements of nexus and the commerce clause elements of nexus. And what the court said, due process, well, let me back up a second. The states, in this case it was North Dakota, but all this, you know, a bunch of states were involved in this. It was sort of a, you know, planned lawsuit. The states were sort of pushing for saying nexus for tax purposes ought to follow the same kinds of rules that liability and due process nexus follows. So you can think, for those of you who are lawyers and are familiar with, for example, tort lawsuits, where you can bring a, you know, you're an individual who lives in Minnesota is injured by a product that was made by a California manufacturer. A California manufacturer has no physical presence in Minnesota, but I think most of you probably know that you can bring a tort lawsuit in Minnesota naming that California company as a defendant under using the long-arm statute. You can require them to defend that lawsuit in Minnesota. What the states were arguing is, gee, those same sorts of rules ought to apply in the tax situation. What the court said was, yes, we agree with you with regard to due process nexus, but we don't agree with you with commerce clause nexus. We're going to hold to the bright line rule that we established in the National Bellis Hess case in 1967 and say that you have, the company has to have an employee or property in the state in order to compel under the Commerce Clause to require to collect. And this is where Pat was saying, well, Commerce Clause is by negative implication to the power that's granted to Congress under the Commerce Clause that the states can't do it. So Congress can authorize the states, notwithstanding the Commerce Clause, to allow this collection obligation. But now the question you raised is sort of, interesting because we're not saying, well, we're going to require them to collect the tax, but it's sort of more like responding to a lawsuit. We just want you to give us your customer list. Who did you sell stuff to in Minnesota so we can go then after them? The question, I would think, nobody's ever litigated this to my knowledge, but the question would be requiring this out-of-state, this Texas or whatever, California, I mean, Dell is in Texas and HP's in California, I assume they don't have Minnesota presence, is what we're requiring them to do by supplying a customer list like a tax compliance thing, or is it more like a tort lawsuit? My instinct is that the court would say the only reason you're doing that is it's a tax collection thing, and you can't require them to do that, but it's not clear. So that's a long answer to and unclear. I mean, it's just there's no definitive answer to this, but I would think the court would likely regard that as being more like a tax collection obligation, and therefore the Commerce Clause rules would apply, than it is just a pure due process thing.
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue some other time.
Members, I think we're going to have ample time to discuss the streamlined sales tax and the various implications of that. So, but thank you for that question, Representative Mullery. Let's go back to talking about things that the rest of us can understand.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do want to make one additional comment about requiring people to pay use tax. In this state, several years ago, the legislature enacted a de minimis exemption. So for individuals making purchases from remote sellers, they do not owe use tax on their first their purchases as long as their purchases do not exceed $770 in a calendar year. And that's the equivalent of $50 in use tax. However, if you go to $775 a year, you owe use tax on all of the purchases. Right now, it's just that we don't enforce that. Getting back to that, one of the things that has been done in response to this whole issue of remote sales and lost state revenue from it is a multi-state effort to reduce the cost of sales tax compliance and administration between states, and that effort is called the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, or SSTP. Minnesota is one of 42 states that are currently involved in this project. That's 42 states out, plus the District of Columbia out of the 45 states that impose the sales tax. There isn't a working agreement. I mean, there isn't a working agreement. There is an agreement that has come out of this process called the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. Minnesota is one of 21 states that has taken at least some action to pass legislation to conform to that agreement. The project is right now in the process of looking at those 21 states and will sometime this year, I believe, be voting on which states are in compliance and which states are not. When 10 states are in compliance, at least 10 states representing at least 20% of the U.S. population are voted as being in compliance with this agreement, this voluntary agreement will go into effect, and those states will be working together to collect taxes on these from remote sellers located in those states. The reason to do this is really twofold. One is to either encourage Congress to impose the duty to collect by simplifying the tax enough that Congress says, okay, it's really not that big burden. Or conversely, to actually have a court case that overturns Quill and says, at least in these states that have simplified and are in agreement with streamlined sales tax, the burden of collecting tax for remote sellers is not an undue burden, and so you can impose that duty to collect. So that's why the state is participating in this streamlined. Finally, the last thing I want to talk about is sales taxes, local sales taxes.
Excuse me one moment. Representative Lincheski, question to streamline sales.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, I know that you've worked very hard on this issue for a long time, and
I attended the National Tax Conference Association. I believe you were there. Most of the House research staff was there, and it was in Minnesota this year, so it was cost-effective to go. But most of the tax House staff was there, and most of the Senate, and a lot of people in revenue. And one thing I heard repeatedly there, and I never heard this before, is that it seems like the streamlined sales tax project is losing ground, or that it's diminishing. And I just wondered, because I know you probably more than anyone in the legislature or in the House would know where that's going, and if it seemed like it was gaining steam. But anecdotally, people from around the country, I got the feeling that they're feeling like this is failing. Can you just speculate as to where you think things are going nationally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, it's kind of a mixed bag. 2 years ago, only about 20 states were participating in the project, and some of the larger states in the U.S., such as California and New York, were not participating. All of those large states are now participating. Clearly, there is some momentum towards moving towards conformity in a lot of states in the last 2 years. 2 years ago, when we made this presentation, only four states had actually enacted legislation to move towards compliance with the agreement, and Minnesota was one of those four states. Now we're at 21. So 2003 and 2004 were years that really saw a big push. Now, if you compare the end of 2004 to that really big push in 2003, yeah, I think it's losing some steam. Are we a lot further along than we were at the start of 2003? Yes, but I think right now, people are really kind of at the point where they're waiting to see what's going to happen at the national level to decide if they're going to take those final steps that they need to take.
Thank you.
Local sales taxes. Generally, general local sales taxes are prohibited in this state unless allowed under special legislation. Minnesota has 13 states and one county that are currently allowed to impose a general local sales tax. They are listed on in the handout if you want to know which cities specifically have them. It's on page 25 of the handout. Duluth has a 1% rate. All the others have a 0.5% rate. And all of the local sales taxes have an expiration except for Duluth and Minneapolis. Minneapolis, in theory, should expire when it's done issuing bonds for its convention center, but it keeps issuing new bonds, so the tax really isn't going to expire. Usually the tax is required to fund a specific bricks and mortar project. There are only two exceptions to that, Duluth, which can use theirs for anything they want, and St. Paul can use a portion of it for some neighborhood arts programs, some neighborhood programs and some arts programs, and so they have a little bit more flexibility to not use it for bricks and mortar. All of the ones that have passed recently have required a local referendum at general election. And a couple of years ago, the legislature passed codified in Chapter 297A, essentially a list of common requirements for all local sales taxes that are approved, that were existing or approved in the future. And they list all of these things like the referendum and a specific project and a required expiration. And with that, I'm done with sales taxes. Defer to Joel.
As Paul indicated, what we're going to do in terms of the taxes is go through them in descending order of their revenue magnitude. And so the next, after the big two of income and sales tax, the corporate franchise tax, this often is referred to as the corporate income tax. The tax base of it is essentially the profits of what are called C corporations. That refers to the subchapter of the Internal Revenue Code that they operate under. And these should be distinguished from S corporations, which are like tax-like partnerships and sole proprietors, in that the tax attributes flow through to the individuals. The world of C corporations has been shrinking as the federal government and the state following it have allowed
more businesses greater flexibility to operate and pass through forms. So anyway, the tax base, again, is net income. That means, you know, it's income, gross income, less expenses, including depreciation and so forth. Now, a real key thing is for multi-state corporations, obviously a state can only tax the portion of a business like Microsoft or Procter & Gamble or 3M, Honeywell, whatever, only the portion of that income that's fairly attributable to the operations in that state. All the states do that using some sort of apportionment formula. The standard has generally been to use a fraction of in-state property, payroll, and sales to determine that in-state share that's subject to tax. Minnesota uses a formula that's weighted heavily towards sales. It's 75% sales weight, 12.5% for the payroll and property factors. The trend in other states has been to also move in that direction of weighting sales more heavily. And the reason why states do this is it favors companies. It provides an incentive for companies to have more of their physical operations in the state, particularly if they sell nationally. So if you've got your factories, your headquarters, and so forth in the state, those count less to figuring out how much of your income is attributable to that state. And so states have been moving in many states, and there's a map in the handout that shows you know, how many states have gone to using only sales apportionment or the formulas that they use. And that see, that map is on page 33, so you can see that. Turning to the corporate franchise tax, like the individual income tax, also has some credits. Credits are much less important under the corporate franchise tax. There's the most important, really the only significant credit, is the research and development credit that provides a percentage credit for research activities that are located in Minnesota. There's also a very small credit that applies only in very unusual circumstances to taxes paid to other states. Mostly, the way the tax works to avoid double taxation by two states is using this apportionment formula. Like the individual income tax, there's a minimum tax, an AMT, under the corporate tax. In addition, there's a second minimum tax that applies not just to C corporations, but to S corporations and partnerships. And this minimum fee is simply based on how much your Minnesota property payroll and sales is, and the maximum fee under it is $5,000. The corporate franchise tax is estimated it will raise about $765 million for the current fiscal year. It's worth noting that the corporate tax is really the most volatile of the major revenue sources. During the recession in the early 80s and the recession in 2001-2002, corporate tax receipts in absolute terms dropped by a third. That's a huge drop. So that's one thing to keep in mind. One other issue that I won't get into talking about the details, this again, if somebody wants to talk about this, you know, one-on-one or in a small group setting, I'm happy to do that, is the foreign source income provisions, which I suspect some of you may have heard about. This is FOCs, foreign operating corporations, the royalty deductions that are allowed. These provisions were enacted back in 1988, so we've had them for 15, 16 years. But recently there's been some concern expressed by the staff at Revenue and the Department of Finance, and there's some, I think, tangible evidence of this, and there's a court case going on now that the Supreme Court has under advisement, that these provisions are being used by some businesses to essentially characterize domestic income as foreign income. And these provisions allow essentially a 80% discount on the tax. They pay only tax on 20% of this income rather than on 100% of it. And so that's likely to be an issue that you'll be hearing about. Turning to the next largest tax, the motor vehicle fuels tax, This is an excise tax that's levied on a per unit basis, so it's just a flat 20 cents per gallon of motor fuel, so it's gasoline, diesel fuel, special fuel, whatever. And it applies to highway use for that fuel.
Excuse me, Joel. Representative Rucavini, do you want to talk about corporate franchise
tax? Yeah, just before we move on, Joel, Mr. Chairman, Joel, is so from July 1 of 2004 to June 30th of 2005, you're saying that we're going to collect $765 million in corporate income tax, and is, or that's the guesstimate. Is it decreasing over the next biennium? What's the projection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina, that $765 is what's in the November Department of Finance forecast for the 2005 fiscal year. They are estimating that it's going to drop to $688 million for FY06. And again, there's a lot of unpredictability and uncertainty about the corporate tax. The economists at finance are just not sure really what's going on, because in the last couple of years, collections have not tracked with the federal government's estimate of corporate profits and our economic consultants' estimates of corporate profits the way they have traditionally. And so that's caused a great deal of uncertainty, and I think it's fair to say they're just not sure what's going on, and they've made some judgments to reduce the forecast rather than simply tracking the estimates of what corporate profits would be nationally.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rose,
this is an observation from this biker from the range, but if I recall correctly, the governor asked the Indian tribes to contribute $350 million a year, which then the Indian tribes in the state would have to pay over 50% of what all the corporations in the state of Minnesota pay in taxes.
Representative Rucavini, you might want to check with the governor on how he's doing in that proposal.
But my interpretation is correct, right, Mr. Chair? As the new chair of the tax committee, that's what he was asking.
You can read the newspaper as well as everyone else, Representative Rucavina. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Question. Chair. Mr. Michael, following up on Representative Rucavina's question, of that 680 or whatever you said it would be roughly next year, what percentage of that or what chunk of that is the FOC stuff, about 80 or 100 million? Or, we'll hear a lot of discussion about that, and sometimes when I talk to people, I think they think it's just hundreds of millions of dollars we're talking about. And relative to the state budget, it's fairly small, I think. So that's one question. And then the second part is, when we think about business tax in general, we think about the corporate income tax. As a subset, there's the FOC. But then there's also the statewide property tax, which I know you'll get to in your next presentation. But what is the number for the statewide business property tax? I'm trying to get the big picture of what is corporate tax in total in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Chair, Representative Lincheski, just to respond to that last question, to put this, the franchise tax in context of the statewide property tax, statewide property tax is a little over $600 million, and that rises with inflation. The statute provides that it just goes up with the CPI, whereas the corporate franchise tax, because it depends on the profits, oscillates a lot. In terms of how much do those foreign source income provisions cost, the tax expenditure budget, again, this document from the Department of Revenue for, did I bring the wrong one? I think I did. I brought the wrong one. It's about $70 million. A little bit less than $70 million a year, that they're estimating that collections would be higher if we did not have all of those provisions, not just the FOC provisions, but the subtraction for foreign royalties that's allowed without regard to whether you have an FOC or not.
Thank you.
Again, members, obviously, we'll be probably discussing this at some length as we go further into the session, so... Let's continue then with the motor vehicle fuels.
Right. turning again to that, again, this is fuel that's used for highway use, but fuel that's used for other uses also pays the excise tax. It's just that it doesn't go into the highway fund. So, for example, boat, snowmobile, ATV, they each have their own dedicated funds, and so the tax, which is collected at the wholesale level, there's an estimate made, and that money gets redirected to purposes related to boating or snowmobile use and so forth. The tax is projected to raise $659 million in FY05. And again, local governments, through through various aid formulas, receive a share of this revenue, which, you know, it's, many of you are very familiar with the discussions about what's called the CASA formula and so on. Turning to the next largest tax, the motor vehicle registration tax, or the, you know, the TAB fees is often the way this is referred to, or the license fee. The tax base for this tax is really a personal property tax at its base, and so the tax base is the value of the passenger vehicle under the manufacturer's base value system. That's the way the value is established. The tax rate is 1.25% of that value. But as a result of the tax reductions that were enacted in 2001, there's a cap on that tax, so that in the first year, the tax applies just at the 1.25% of what the base value is under the manufacturer's schedule. But in the second year, as a result of, you know, Governor Ventura's, I think in the one-third deal that was cut, that's capped at $189 in the second year, and then it drops to $99 in the third year. All vehicles pay at least $35 a minimum fee, plus there's a little additional transaction charge attached to that. And again, the revenues from this are estimated to be about $500 million for 05, and they go into the Highway User Trust Fund, and so they also are subject to this distribution. Some of it goes to the Trunk Highway Fund, and some of it goes to the County and Municipal State Aid Street Funds. The next largest tax is the Minnesota Care Tax, and this is a gross revenue tax that's imposed on an assortment of healthcare providers: hospitals, physicians, chiropractors, dentists, psychologists, so forth, all licensed healthcare providers. The tax rate's 2%. It was 1.5% before it got it automatically got ratcheted up a couple of years ago. There are limited exemptions from this. The biggest one is Medicare. So when a physician gets reimbursed by Medicare, that does not go into the gross revenues that's subject to the 2% tax. And as a result of a lawsuit, the Federal Employees Health Program revenues are also exempt from it. The revenues that go into the Healthcare Access Fund, which is used to finance the Minnesota Care Insurance Program, revenues for 05 are estimated to be $353 million. See, I guess we got that slide in there twice for some reason. The next tax is the insurance premiums tax. And here the tax base, this is sort of like a sales tax on insurance, although it's not added onto the bill per se, but rather it's levied on at the company level as sort of like a gross revenues tax. The basic tax rate is 2%. That's the same rate that most states apply. There are some lower rates that apply in special circumstances. Town farmers mutuals are subject to a lower rate. Small mutual insurance companies are subject to a lower rate. Fraternal benefit societies, sort of like Thrivent, the Catholic, I can't think of what their similar organization is to Thrivent, but those fraternal benefit societies are exempt from the tax. They don't pay it, even though what the product they sell is really very similar to insurance, or it is insurance. The rate that applies to HMOs and to the Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and so forth is a 1% rate. And that gets dedicated to the Minnesota Care Healthcare Access Fund. One interesting feature about the insurance premiums tax is that Congress, back in 1940s, enacted what's called the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which exempts insurance taxation from these Commerce Clause restrictions that we were talking about earlier in the sales tax context. So that gives the state much more freedom to design insurance taxes because they don't need to worry about these Commerce Clause restrictions. And one of the things that states have done is that they've enacted retaliatory taxes. And basically what a retaliatory tax does is if you being the other state, tax our insurance companies more heavily, we will tax your insurance companies under the same rate and base regime that applies in your state. So, to put that into understandable lingo, if, for example, Minnesota has a 2% tax, let's assume, well, this is a real example, Iowa has a 1% tax on life insurance. And so when a Minnesota life insurance company operates in Iowa, which has a retaliatory tax just like almost all states do, the Iowa company that sells life insurance to an Iowa buyer will pay the Iowa 1% tax. But when the Minnesota-based company sells a life insurance policy to an Iowa buyer, Iowa will say, oh no, you're not going to pay the 1% tax that applies generally, but instead our retaliatory tax applies. And when you tax an Iowa company in Minnesota, you tax them at 2%, so we're going to tax you, Minnesota company, at 2% too. So the Minnesota company who's selling the policy in Iowa pays a 2% tax, whereas the Iowa company selling a policy to that same buyer would pay a 1% tax. And Minnesota has a tax like this. All states except New Mexico and Hawaii have retaliatory regimes like this. And now there are other states that have taxes higher than 2%. And so when their companies sell insurance in Minnesota, they pay at the higher rate. So that's one of the really quirky features of the insurance tax that you won't see in any other of the state taxes. And the only reason the states can do this is because Congress has permitted it under the McCarran-Ferguson Act. Revenues from the insurance premium tax, some of them are dedicated, as I indicated, the HMO and Blues tax goes to the Healthcare Access Fund to help fund Minnesota Care. And some of the taxes on liability insurance, like auto insurance, life insurance, get dedicated to pay for police and fire pension aid. Cigarette and tobacco taxes, these are excise taxes, like the motor fuels tax, are a per unit tax, so it's, you know, per cigarette, not in the price of cigarettes. Tax rates, 48 cents per pack of 20. Tobacco products, though, are a little different. Here we're talking about cigars, pipe tobacco, snuff, chewing tobacco, so forth. Those products are subject to a percentage tax that will rise as prices rise. That tax rate is 35%. The cigarette and tobacco tax generally goes to the general fund and just is available for general purposes, but about 20% of the revenues are dedicated to a couple of health funds, and those dedications are done on a cents per pack basis. The revenues from the cigarette and tobacco taxes are about $180 million per year. These revenues are flat, pretty flat. I think it raised about the same amount of revenue back 2 years ago. And that reflects the fact that people aren't smoking more cigarettes. In fact, the number of smokers is declining. But the tobacco products tax is rising with inflation as those products have grown, and so that helps, you know, keep the revenue somewhat flat. The next tax, again by magnitude, is the mortgage registry tax. This tax is imposed on the principal of mortgage debt in the state. The rate's 0.23% of the principal amount. It's generally collected by the at the county level and remitted to the state. The county keeps 3%. State gets the balance. The revenues are estimated to be $150 million, or a little $154 million for 2005. And this tax, because of all the refinancing activity that's going on, because every time you do a refinancing, it generates more tax, has been growing quite a bit. The deed transfer tax is the next tax. It's sort of a similar to the mortgage tax, except that it applies when there's a transfer of the deed. So when you it's not triggered by a refinancing, but by sales of property where there's actual transfer. Tax rate's a little bit higher. It's 0.33% of the consideration. Technically, it's paid by the transferor, and again, the county keeps 3%. Revenues are $133 million. See if I can manage to get through the rest of the state taxes before the end of the hour. The estate tax is a somewhat interesting tax. It's something that the legislature hasn't dealt with much during the 1990s because it was before the 2001 Federal Tax Act, federal government allowed states to essentially impose an estate tax at no cost to their residents because the tax was a dollar-for-dollar credit against the federal tax. So if a state chose not to impose this tax, it had no effect on their residents' tax burden. It simply meant that more money went to the federal government. So you can guess that all states jumped on that opportunity and imposed a tax at least equal to what that federal credit was. And that was called a pickup or a sponge tax. There are a few states, not many, there were a few, 15 or so, that had additional taxes that were above that amount of the federal credit. Well, in 2001, in the big tax bill that passed Congress, they repealed over 3 years that credit. So states can no longer now, starting in 2005, have this happy situation where you impose a tax that is of no burden to your estates. When that happened, Minnesota decided to decouple and to go to a standalone tax. And so that's what we have now. Tax is based on the value of the estate at the time of death. Transfers to the surviving spouse are exempt. The exemption amount for the current year is $850,000. The exemption amount under the federal tax is $1.5 million by contrast. The exemption is scheduled to rise to $1 million in 2006. The federal exemption goes up to $2 million and then to $3.5 million. Tax rates range from 4.8% to 16%. This tax is estimated to the estate tax is estimated to raise about $82 million for this next year. Again, like the corporate tax, this tax is a very volatile tax. And just to give you a taste of that, in the PowerPoint, you can see in 2003 we collected $122 million. In 2001 we collected $54 million. The explanation for the 2003 number is that one estate generated a $55 million tax liability in 2003. Interestingly, I indicated in Minnesota's response to this federal tax act was to go to a standalone tax. Most states, 30 states out of 50, have not done that. As of 2005, they will not have an estate tax anymore. There's a map in the handout, and you can see there's a real geographic distribution to this. The states that don't have estate taxes are concentrated in the South and West, and you can think about it, they're typical retirement destination places like Florida, Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and so forth. In fact, both Florida, Nevada, and I believe Mississippi have constitutional prohibitions on state taxation. One of the big issues is whether or not Minnesota's and states that continue to impose the state taxes, will that affect sort of domiciled decisions by wealthy individuals. This tax only applies to very wealthy people. The top 2% essentially of the states, basically. Turning to the last tax I'll talk about is the alcoholic beverage excise tax. This is sort of like the cigarette tax. Again, it's a per unit tax. Tax rate varies by beverage type. Highest for liquor or distilled spirits at $5 a gallon, roughly. $30 for your standard, 30 cents a gallon for your standard cable wine. Or wait, I think that should be meager. And it's quite a bit lower for beer. Taxes unrelated to alcoholic content or price, even though the tax on wine escalates a little bit for higher alcohol concentration, there's very little of that kind of wine that's sold. It's estimated that the tax will raise $66 million in 2005. And again, this tax, because it's a per-unit tax, has been fairly flat. There are three slides on the Jobs E program, which I'll go to that, and then next on Thursday we can start with property taxes. Jobs E, as I'm sure you're all familiar, is an enterprise zone that the legislature enacted in 2003. Zones are located only outside the Twin Cities. In order to get the tax breaks, you have to be a qualified business. It's not restricted as to the type of business, but the business has to either be already located in the zone or has to meet an expansion or test if they're relocating from elsewhere in the state to the zone. In order to get the tax breaks, you have to sign a business subsidy agreement with the administrator, the city or the county that's administering the zone. The tax incentives that are available in Jobs Z are quite broad-ranging. They include individual income tax exemptions for the business income, for rent, and capital gains attributable to business operations in the zone. There's a corporate franchise tax exemption, property tax exemption for business property in the zone, and there's a refundable jobs credit for higher-paying jobs. This credit is a 7% credit that kicks in for compensation between $30,000 and $100,000 a year. So if you have a job that pays less than $30,000, you don't get it on that part of it. Just in terms of the designations, D designated 10 of these zones with 325 subzones, encompassing about 29,000 acres. As of January 6th, they were reporting they had 120 completed business subsidy agreements in these zones. And you can go to their website for information on, you know, the number of jobs and so forth. The program also provides five agricultural processing zones. D designated one of these, so they still have the authority to designate four more of those zones. And there's more information about both of those programs on both the House Research website and the Deed website if you're interested. With that, I'll stop and we can on Thursday talk about property taxes and process.
Thank you very much. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, I did have the answer to Representative Cole's question with me on the working family credit. And in 2002, there was about $128 million paid out in working family credit, $25 million of that offset tax liability, and the remaining $103 million was paid as a refund. So it's about 80% paid as a refund and about 20% the offset liability.
Hey, members, just one announcement. Add to the agenda on Thursday, Representative Abrams' bill concerning charitable contributions to tsunami victims. So that will be on the schedule for Thursday. And then we'll continue with the discussion of from our staff on property tax overview. So with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.